from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's part three of our special series on truth: what it is, how we define it, how we perceive it, and today, how it's manipulated. In other words, we're going to take a close look at truth and power. And here's an example. It's a small one, but a significant one. In the run-up to the Iraq War, September 2002, the British government released a special dossier about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now, questionable intelligence was already being used to sell the war in the United States, and it was about to happen in the UK, too, because that dossier contained an alarming assertion that quickly dominated news in Britain. It claimed that the Iraqi military was able to, quote, deploy chemical or biological weapons within 45 minutes of an order to do so, end quote. And that claim, throughout the late 2002 and 2003, was repeated by then Prime Minister Tony Blair.
I am quite sure, I think most people are, that he has these weapons and that the people and the documentation exist to show that.
Well, it wasn't true. And it wasn't until a few years later, 2004, that an official parliamentary inquiry found that the claim was open to, quote, misinterpretation. But by then, that claim had done its work. The U.S. and the U.K. had consolidated public support, misinformation had helped shape a narrative, and coalition troops had invaded Iraq. Now, as I said, it's just one tiny example of how power shapes perceived truths in a democracy. So one question we're going to ask this hour is, how much more does that happen in authoritarian countries? Now, we have 100 years worth of examples in just the 20th century alone. So this hour on Point, truth and power. And since we used that example of how the UK and the US used information and different narratives to sell the Iraq War, we actually thought we would start by hearing the voice of an Iraqi who lived through that experience in Iraq. So Razak Al-Sayedi joins me today in the studio. And he lived in Iraq under the rule of Saddam Hussein. After Hussein was overthrown in the 2003 invasion of Iraq, Razak became a stringer for the New York Times covering the ongoing war and Iraqi politics. He later went on to work on truth commissions for the United Nations. Today, he's a researcher and fellow with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. So, Razak Al-Sayedi, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, I just wanted to quickly hear from you. You lived in an authoritarian state under the rule of Saddam Hussein.
True.
Just hearing how Tony Blair used that one fact in a democracy about that 45-minute claim, how does that compare to the kinds of things that you heard on a daily basis before 2003, 2002 in Iraq in terms of how truth or narratives were used?
Yeah. You know, when I lived in Iraq, we had no access to truth. Or we don't have any access to information except the Saddam's media. I remember that time we had only two TV channels, one run by the government and the other one run by Saddam's son. We have only had four newspapers or had the same front page, which is Saddam photo. So we didn't have any access to the, you know, to truth. So there was no internet. There is no, you know, there is no free press or free media or free, you know, expressions. We had no access even to some information that might affect your life. I have a brother, my little brother, who disappeared in 1993. About time he had three kids and we would live together, and he was just kidnapped or arrested, if you may say, by one of the secret police or security, you know, apparatus, and, you know, disappear. And then I spent 10 years of my life, you know, looking for him. I tried to find the truth or what happened to him, why he was taken, what happened. Well, no information. We were even afraid to ask, about what happened to him. So 10 years later, after the invasion in 2003, I find out about him when I found his grave. So even you didn't have, access to, Yeah, he was killed on the same day. I'm sorry, the same year that he was arrested. So he was arrested in May 1993. Then he was executed in November 1993, and they were buried in a secret mass grave in Abu Ghraib prison. And then 10 years, I found the I found the record.
So I mean, it was impossible, you're saying, for you to find the truth. For years about what had happened to your own brother.
I would have lost my life if I will keep asking, because there is no way to ask. So only thing, I bribed some people behind the scene in order to get any information. And someone told me, you know, I found him here. Someone said, you might find him in that way, because you had no idea. It's just like a black hole. This is the security, you know, underground, the prisons or the jails. And by the way, at that time, he was a government employee. He was an engineer. He was a director of a state construction company. He was a colonel in the army. So he was not like nobody. You know, he has kids, he has family, and it's all gone.
And even trying to ask about what the truth was carried enormous risk.
Yeah, because I'll give you an example. There is a big building, huge building, downtown Baghdad. We all know this building. It's the it's called Alam Alam, which is the general security building. But there's no sign. It's only checkpoints. We all know this is the place that thousands of people were arrested. But who dared to ask? Even if I will ask, they will ask. He said, "Who told you he's here? Who told you we are there?" So it's like no way you even, you could ask, or you could do. Even if you ask, you know, some people, no one would help you. I was like a pariah. All his friends just abandoned me. It's just like you become, your family or my family were categorized as the enemy of the regime. Uh-huh. No one touched you. No one even, talked to you, No one even, try to approach you, because it's like, wow, you're, so... It's like your quarantine.
What were some of the other ways that the regime tried to shape what people believed was true?
It's only his, his versions of the truth.
Saddam's version.
Which is only one version. And we have to, we have to believe it. So the only access, I was talking to my friend today, he was one of the, and I said, what was our access for information or for that? Do you know what? It's only the radio transistors. Huh. That was the only way, which is I listened to the Voice of America, of course, in Arabic, or the BBC Arabic, and it tried to know, exactly. So there was no internet, there was no feed. So it's only things that you have to believe the, the regime of propaganda, which is, Saddam. Saddam had, they create 99 names for him. You can imagine, I don't know who is the creative, person to give the name 99, like the leader, the Arab sword, the hero, the generous. And do you know why 99, not 100?
Because there's only one being that has 100 names in Islam, right?
In Islam, it's only God or Allah had 99 names. So you cannot have
more
a human being. To have more than 99. But however, we all lived in lies. In fact, we lied to each other. We lied to our family. We lied to our kids. Because among our kids or our family, we never say something bad about Saddam. We said, our kids, Saddam is your father. Saddam is our uncle. Saddam is our hero. Mm. Saddam, he destroyed our lives. He destroyed our family and our youth. And guess what? His photo... It in our living room, even maybe in bedrooms. We cannot dare. We don't have a photo, nice photo, not just a photo, well framed and a huge one, not small one. And you have to put it in the living room, because when the member of Ba'ath Party, they visit you and regular visit to every single family in order to check record about the information. If they don't see the photo, they will tell you, where's the Mr. President photo? So you have to live with this lie. Mm. On the 28th of April of each year, we have to decorate, because it's Saddam's birthday, we have to, decorate our offices and our stores and celebrate. We have to show that. Otherwise, you will, you know.
Whether you want to or not, right? You had to show that you celebrated his birthday.
Yeah, the consequences. I remember I was, you know, I ran a store as a business, and one of the member in the bath party in the neighborhood came to me. I said, today is the 28th. Do you know that? I said, yeah. I said, where's the decoration? I said, oh, I'm sorry. I just signed for someone to buy the decoration. Yeah. And then with a few minutes, I would decorate it and put Saddam photo, and I celebrate. I pretend I celebrate Saddam's birthday. Mm. So that's the lie we lived. And we know this man. We all despise him. And we all, you know, he destroyed the country. And it's still now we paid what Saddam's, you know, took out, you know, through the whole country, from war to dictatorship to, you know, oppressions. You know, thousands of people. I worked at in 2000, you know, three in Iraq, which is called the, you know, the transitional process in order to how to deal with the legacy of massive of a human rights violation. Thousands of people of family of missing persons, still now called missing person, because we, you know, no one know exactly, you know, what happened to them or what happened to them. So sometimes even you have no access to truth, that truth affect significantly your life or your family. You don't have the access to the, you know, to this kind of information.
What impact, what effect did it have on you? I'm very gripped by this idea that you even had felt like you had to lie to members of your own family about Saddam himself, right? You were saying that you were the culture was so surrounded by lies that you're even telling your children lies about Saddam. I mean, we just have a few seconds, but what impact did that have on you as a person?
I think it has, it's a traumatized.
Okay. So, Razak, hold on for just a second because I do have to take a quick break. I'll let you finish the answer when we come back. It is part three of our series on truth, and today we're examining truth and power and how truth is manipulated and exploited in authoritarian societies. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's part three of our special series about truth, where we're examining what truth is, how we perceive it, how it's manipulated. And we're doing this series in collaboration with TheConversation.com, the nonprofit journalism group. And I'm joined today by Razak Al-Saidi. And Razak, just before the break, I had asked you about what impact it had on you as a person to be so surrounded by lies and not have access to the truth. And you said it was traumatizing. So tell me a little bit more.
I think as individuals, it's a traumatized because you have to tell lie every, and you have to receive lies, and you have to tell them, and you have to live. So it seems it's all your life lived. It's a lie. And regarding collectively or the society, even now, not just in Iraq, in many, many places in Middle East who live under dictatorships, they never trust the government. They never trust media. They never trust public media. I did like a small survey in 2003, just after the invasion, and asked people, do you trust the government? And the majority said, no way. You know, we don't. But of course, we talk about the Saddam's, you know, government said, no, we don't trust. You know, we don't trust government. We don't trust judiciary. We don't trust any public institutions. I did with Harvard last year, a survey, and I asked the same question, which is now Iraq should be a democratic.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have a free election. We have free media at some point, you know. Of course, we are. That's in theory. And guess what? It's the same answers.
No trust still.
No.
Hmm.
Same answers. It's a legacy. So, you know, we have a proverb in Arabic. It's called, when you tell me lie, I say, this is Kalam Jarayid. Kalam Jarayid mean in newspaper words. Because in our legacy, all the newspaper is about lie.
Oh, I see.
So therefore, it's mistrust. You don't know it's true, even if someone tells you it's the theory of transparency everywhere. So no one trusts anyone. No one believes in anything. And I think this is the trauma. Still, the legacy is still so far.
Well, Razak, hold on here for just a second, because I want to bring in two more people into this conversation. Joining us from Dayton, Ohio is Shelley Inglis. Shelley is an executive director or the executive director of the Human Rights Center and professor of human rights and law at the University of Dayton. Shelley, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Magda.
And also with us in the On Point studio is Cynthia Hooper, professor of history and director of Russian and Eastern European Studies at the College of the Holy Cross and author of the forthcoming Terror of Intimacy, Family Politics in the 1930s, Soviet Union and Everyday Life in Early Soviet Russia. Cynthia, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So Shelley and Cynthia, you've been patiently listening to Razak's sort of lived experience under an authoritarian government of Saddam Hussein. And Shelley, let me just start with you. How much of what Razak shared about how information was controlled, how truth was shaped and manipulated, is common to other authoritarian governments throughout the 20th century?
Well, very common, I think. Obviously, there are differences in the authoritarian governments and how they worked throughout the 20th century. And I would like to get to the point of where we start to talk about what we have now, because we have a very different landscape when it comes to autocracy and democracy than even when Razak was referring to in Iraq. And we have a different information landscape. But just to note, I think there are other means by which authoritarian governments create an understanding of truth or a misunderstanding of truth in addition to what Razak mentioned. And a lot of that is around more subtle ways in the culture and in society, and particularly through history, curricula, teaching, and education, that regimes instill ways of viewing fact and information and ways of viewing the regime itself. So you even look at a contemporary place like Bosnia and Herzegovina that went through quite a significant war in the 90s. And it really depends on which ethnic group, which part of the country you're in, what history you get, whether you get the Bosnian Muslim version of history, whether you get the Croat version of history, or whether you get the Serb version of history. So it's not only through the lack of independent media or independent sources at the time. It's also through the institutions that are cultivated within society, through the home, through education, through song, through what's allowed on TV, traditional music. There are many different ways through symbols that certain ideas about how truth is formed and certain ways of repressing truth is manifested in autocracies.
Well, that's fascinating. And Cynthia, Shelley, I take your point about getting to today. We'll eventually do that. And in fact, honestly, part four of our series tomorrow is going to be all about, and from start to finish, about sort of where we are now regarding truth. But Cynthia, let me turn to you and especially lean on your expertise in the 1930s. Same question to you. How much of what Razak said sort of rang as familiar to you?
Such a lot. In fact, I was really struck, Razak, when you were talking about the need to celebrate Saddam's birthday, because it reminded me of these documents I read after Stalin's death, when everybody in the Soviet Union had to come together and attend public commemoration services. And there are actually police reports written about every single meeting at the most local of levels that actually report in some detail on, like, the demeanor of the speakers and who had tears in their eyes and what was said. And it was very, very important to demonstrate that there were, like, appropriate displays of sorrow. And also just the idea of life under the Soviet Union as being filled with secrecy. I mean, so much of the regime operated in kind of need-to-know bases that it was literally often that, like, the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. And this could be in, you know, very powerful ways. Like Mikhail Gorbachev himself said once he came to power in 1985 that he had only recently found out that his grandfathers had been victims of political repression because they'd been arrested and come back and never told anybody. And even then, on a more, you know, joking basis, like it's a funny story to tell about how Yuri Gagarin's wife didn't even know he was an astronaut until she heard on the radio that he had made it successfully into space. But just, if you don't mind, I'd like to twist it, though, mm-hmm, a little bit, mm-hmm, and also point out that in Soviet history, it's a bit more complicated, because the times when leaders came to power, and that's after Stalin's death, when Nikita Khrushchev took control, and then when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power a couple decades later in 1985, and they both began to speak about the need for more glasnost, which is this Russian word for openness. And when that happened, there was an immediate public backlash. Not everybody was against openness, but half the population, at least, was livid that suddenly it was okay to dig your hands into the country's dirty laundry and try to expose crimes and generally make people feel badly about sacrifices that they may have made for the sake of the regime. And this is something, I mean, to bring it, if you don't mind, to the present day, sure, for just a second, sure, this is something that Vladimir Putin is extraordinarily aware of. And surveys show that the majority of Russians today actually don't entirely disapprove of censorship. They actually think that it's appropriate if it's in the interests of national security or if it's to preserve the dignity of the state. And he has invested all kinds of resources into constructing a positive history of the Soviet Union. So, for instance, he started his New Year's Eve address off by talking about this is a big year for us because it's the 75th anniversary of victory against the Nazis and the Great Patriotic War. But this is now commemorated every single day in a story some way on state television. Uh-huh. And even Russia 24, which is the second biggest state-funded television source, is begun a program, started on February 24th, which was a military holiday. They are running the names of every single soldier that died in the Second World War. So it's almost 13 million names. And that's not even the total casualties the Soviet Union suffered, because there were more civilian casualties.
That's right.
So the total number is like 25 or 30 million. Mm-hmm. But they're showing 100 names a minute, and it's going to take from February 24th, 24 hours a day, until May 9th, which is Victory Day in the in Russia, and now become the major national holiday for that process to end.
And the intent being?
To remind people, twofold, to remind people of what was the greatest achievement of the Soviet Union, which was defeating Hitler. Also to remind people of the way the sacrifice has not been fully appreciated by the West, which sort of commemorates D-Day as the 24 hours that saved the world by and large. And, you know, Ronald Reagan gave a speech in 1984 commemorating the 40th anniversary of D-Day, a very famous, great speech, but where he never mentioned Soviet citizens as fighting against Nazism. He only mentioned them as victims of first, you know, fascist dictatorship and then communist dictatorship.
Wait, if I just jump in here, and I haven't forgot about you, Razak, or you, Shelley, but And since we're talking about the control and flow of information within authoritarian regimes, which there's the de facto presumption that authoritarian regimes are bad, what you're just describing, though, Cynthia, about the commemoration of the names of 13 million Soviets who died in the Second World War, and the sort of the celebration, not celebration, but the commemoration of that sacrifice and the criticism of how the West sees it, honestly, just to be fair, like if the tables had been turned and 13 million Americans had died or 13 million people in various Western democracies.
Oh, it was 25 or 30 million, 30
million
people
right.
total.
But what I'm getting to is I imagine a very similar kind of commemoration happening in democracies. So what's the difference between that and how it's being done in Putin's Russia?
It's very similar, but it is seeking to create a national narrative through right. processes that we also deploy, that seeks to emphasize that Russians have a past that they can be proud of, and in fact they have accomplishments that should be acknowledged throughout the world, and you know, the commemorating Victory Day is not only one piece in this puzzle. Like, billions of dollars have gone into building something called Patriot Park, which is kind of referred to as a military Disneyland, and it's supposed to encourage civic spirit education and form an attractive image of service in the armed forces. There's also these new Russian historical parks called Russia My History, and they're the one in Moscow is the largest multimedia museum in Europe, and it's dedicated to presenting positive moments over 1,000 years of history.
You know, Shelley, let me turn back to you, because in terms of how authoritarian governments control the narrative or control information and how that amplifies their power, in modern authoritarian governments, is there a need to create the appearance of independence in certain places? Is there a need to create the appearance of legitimate debate? And I underscored the word appearance, because interestingly, that's something I did not hear in Razak's stories about growing up in Iraq. But does that happen in modern authoritarian governments?
Oh, yes. I think more and more so. And a part of Razak's story is, you know, the time that we were talking about, 1993, when forms of media weren't available that could break through the authoritarian control, the TV channels and the newspapers, which are controlled by the state. And in many of these countries, in autocracies today, there is still some state control over the media, of course. But there has been, as you know, a huge rise in democratization throughout the world. So most countries in 1980, for example, about half the countries were closed autocracies. By 2017, there are only about 12% of the regimes in the world. So most countries claim some form of democratic legitimacy. Mm. So today's Russia claims that it is a democracy in many different ways. And that's true of almost all regimes that we might be talking about today, including Razak's Iraq. So that process of sort of creating the attributes of democracy, so free and fair elections, having some level of freedom of association, universal suffrage, an elected executive, forms of freedom of expression. There have been many countries that have developed these institutions and are now at the point where they are able to co-opt and to manipulate these institutions in a way that furthers their aims. But they have these institutions to make it look as if there is a depth of democracy or democratic legitimacy to what they're doing.
Right.
So that's why it's much harder nowadays to understand what we're talking about, because the changes in government or the clear demonstrations of autocratic power are more difficult to identify. In the past, we had large changes in government like coups, or we had electoral fraud that if you monitored, you could tell. We had mass incarceration or disappearances of people in the opposition parties or of independent journalists and human rights defenders. But today we have much more subtle forms of controlling narratives, subtle forms of co-opting the institutions that we assume have a role in ensuring democracy. And the countries are getting that are autocratic and including the autocratization of democracies, which is what we're seeing, which is the most startling trend that we're seeing right now, are getting better and better at this. And this combines with a new form of media, of course, much more open media. And that can be both a democratizing force, but also a very clear means of manipulation as well and disinformation.
Well, let me just let Razak, let me give him a moment here to jump in. I mean, how does this all sounding to you, having, you know, lived through this both in Iraq and now, you know, many years here in the United States, what Shelley was just saying? How do you respond to that?
You know, the irony is if you have too little freedom, you cannot know the truth. But if you have too much, you are spoiled and you don't value it as much as you would if it was more rare. So it seems that maybe too much information, it's more technical than, you know, than political. It's like now, you know, I mean, people, I think, who control media, that who control the technology. So because it's too much maybe information, maybe people now, they don't really care about the truth. They don't value the truth. They want to believe in what they want to believe.
Right. Well, we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, it's part three of our special series about truth. It's a series we're producing in collaboration with the nonprofit journalism group, TheConversation.com. And today, we're exploring truth in authoritarian governments and lessons to be learned about how truth is manipulated by those in power. And I'm joined today by Razak Al-Sayedi. Razak was born and raised in Iraq under the rule of Saddam Hussein. Today, he is a researcher and fellow with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative and also works with Physicians for Human Rights. He's worked on truth commissions for the UN as well. Shelley Inglis joins us. She's executive director of the Human Rights Center and professor of human rights and law at the University of Dayton. And Cynthia Hooper is with us as well. She's a professor of history and director of Russian and Eastern European Studies at the College of the Holy Cross. Now, Cynthia, before the break, Shelley was talking about how there seems to be now in authoritarian governments kind of almost a requirement for a theater of independence is what I would call it. I just wonder, what did you think about that in terms of the new ways in which truth and narratives and information is being controlled. Your response to that?
Yeah, I agree with her in most respects. But I would add that I think that there are some very big sort of authoritarian capitalist countries, and I'm thinking about Russia and China in particular, which have created institutions that they have police and judiciary and such that are not necessarily there to like protect the citizens, but to make the state more effective. And so I think we have to think about the fact that these countries, they want to have economic growth. They want to be successful. And in order to do that, they have to find some way of creating widespread consent. I mean, no country functions very efficiently when people feel like slaves all the time. And I think that this culture of consent also needs to be examined, because it's very convenient for people to always sort of think about like the state as being separate from society. Mm. So it's, you can have this like idea of an evil state, but these very good people who are suffering under this evil state. And if they had freedom, they would do things differently. And that's, you know, how people often remember their experiences living under regimes like Nazi Germany when World War II is over. And they say like, oh, I, you know, never believed and I just had to obey because otherwise I would be killed. And boy, I'm feeling a lot of sympathy for people who are stuck living under political regimes they don't agree with these days. But I think that that kind of explanatory mechanism is too simplified. And, you know, and so I'm thinking a lot of very pessimistic things in this day and age, because I'm thinking, first of all, if you look at like a parable in the middle of this big novel called The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky, it deals with this a situation where sort of Jesus is returned to earth during the time of the Spanish Inquisition, and he's performed miracles, attracted followers, been arrested, and there's this confrontation with the Grand Inquisitor who says, why did you come back to earth? The church doesn't need you anymore, and you're not even helping humanity. And in a very famous line, he says, people, you know, won't want to follow you. Most people prefer to live and die happily in ignorance than to take on the burden of freedom. And in a lot of ways today, I think that we're seeing a devaluing of the importance of truth in power, and maybe a sense that what matters more is like effectiveness. So if you just bear with me, two yeah. quick examples. I'm thinking of China today where, you know, and I don't speak for the nation, but there is a sense that even people who feel badly, say, about the suppression of dissent at Tiananmen Square. So it was 30 years ago last year, 1989. Thousands mm-hmm. of students probably were massacred who were demonstrating for greater civil yeah. liberties. And then the government like kind of erased public memory of that. So young people today, many of them don't even know what happened. Even people in China who care about that, and many don't, they still have great respect for the fact that the government since that time, since the 80s, has managed to move 800 million people at least from a condition of abject poverty into the middle class. And they believe that that perhaps could only have been achieved through like top-down, maybe despotic, maybe ruthless control and guided planning.
Well, if I can just jump in here for a second, because I'd love to get Razak's response to this, because you are the person in this conversation who has lived in an authoritarian regime. And I just wanted to hear what you thought about this notion that that there is some sort of consent coming from people that allows an authoritarian regime to continue to project its power and shape the truth. Because I heard that, and I take your point, Cynthia, but I heard that and I just immediately thought, well, one can an authoritarian regime can gain consent by threatening violence, by disappearing your brother. That is a means by which of getting consent, but it's violence, it's death. It's not really consent, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah, I think it's oppression. It's violent, you know, for sure. And you know, I was listen to Cynthia when she just talked about the record about the, 13 million soldiers, and which is this is fact. So here, when I work in a truth-seeking process in authoritarian regime or that regimes that they shifted from dictatorship to democracy, mainly like in Middle East, like in Iraq or in Libya. So truth here, it really matters. It's especially to the victim, because for them, it's part of the reparation. So they need to be recognized what happened to them. So therefore, the truth here, it's really valuable to them in order to be recognized. It's also reparations. It's just like what happened, you know, in the Holocaust, you know, for the Jews, you know, during the, the Nazis. Mm. It's, to memorize, you know, this thing. So therefore, we have to build the truth-seeking process in this country in order to build a national historical, you know, record. Because here's the question, why do we need to know the truth? Why do you need to find the truth? What's the point? You know, Cynthia just mentioned, or maybe it's like people now, they don't care truth, they care about the economy. They care about, you know, I said, you know, don't tell me the truth, you know, just give me a good job. You know, raise me from poverty to middle class, whatever, and you can do whatever you want to me. I don't care if you tell, you know, lies or whatever. Maybe at some point, because this is a new era, especially with the newer technology, and it's too much information on people, you know, they really, you know, they don't care about the truth now. But at some point, we still, on this world, there are some people, they really want the truth. Even now, I mean, working with society, it's a small society, minorities called the Yazidis, which is they were subjected to a genocide by ISIS. So even the, you know, these people, truth is so important because they need to be recognized as that a genocide, you know, committed against, against them in order to be this. So here, it's, I think it's different if you are grew up or lived in a Western, very democratic, open society, or if you are lived in, you know, in Iraq or other place, or, you know, what kind of, you know, violation. I think that maybe, you know, play a role in how you care about the truth or value the truth.
I see. Go ahead, Shelley.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in here because I think there's a lot of interesting points and I wanted to problematize some of them a little bit. The first one is, I think truth-seeking type mechanisms, while they are extremely important, I worked at the United Nations for over 15 years on supporting them in post-conflict countries like Iraq. They have taken hold in democracies as well, including in the United States, for example, around racial injustice and the history of racial injustice and slavery. And I think those processes mean a lot to people in democracies as well, when democracies have, as they all do, histories of injustice enslavement or in some cases sort of wide-scale discrimination that makes sure that certain voices are not heard. You can look in the Me Too movement and the focus around the Weinstein trial and that trial being a sort of truth-seeking type mechanism for people to start to understand what is the truth of lived experiences of women and in Hollywood, but throughout the world in terms of sexual violence and exploitation. So I think truth seeking remains very important to people. Mm-hmm. I do think that there is something to be said about this idea of efficiency and economic growth and where that has taken us. And there's great data now on people's perception of capitalism, of economic growth, both in the United States and in China and throughout the world, and how they feel about it. And the trends are certainly that people are questioning, because of the high levels of inequality, that capitalism is delivering the results, or that global economic development is delivering the results for regular people. And so you see these social movements against certain economic policies that are happening throughout the world, in Lebanon and Chile, all over the world, around economic policies that people feel are just unjust. Yeah. And I would like to also just mention that the idea of disappearances and these kinds of very violent means of cracking down on the society still continue today. And in fact, we are in a global trend of a narrowing civic space. So narrowing the space for civil society to act, to disagree, to monitor, to hold truth to power, Only about 3% of the world's population lives in a truly open society.
Right.
And about 14% of the world's population lives in a society where there's narrowed space. And there is a ton of techniques that authoritarian and democracies are using around censorship, licensing of civil society, ensuring that civil society can't get foreign donors. You can look at Orban's Hungary and the attack on George Soros, who has been a means for many of the countries in Eastern Europe to be able to develop their civil society, independent journalism. So these are trends that we're not seeing so much in the media, but are really concerning if you're looking at the world's population and their access to and ability to hold truth to power.
Well, we have only about 4 minutes left here. This hour has really raced by. And Cynthia, I know you wanted to jump in here. Just so give me the quick thought that you have. And then I do have one last question that I'd like to wrap up with. But go ahead, Cynthia.
Well, I very much hope that the majority of people care about truth-seeking. But I think that more often than not, many people are prepared to make compromises in order to take care of like themselves and their loved ones and their small personal circle. And I think that, unfortunately, in our society today, many people are quite complacent and find truth or the search for truth a very difficult, problematic, ugly, and disturbing kind of thing. And your show yesterday talked a lot about how people are now taking advantage of a fragmented media environment to surround themselves with like visions of the world that confirm how they would like it to be. How you know? So they prefer a pleasant sense of the world rather than something that might be more true but more menacing. And I will also say, to bring it back to Razak's mention of the first Gulf War, I was in Germany when the first Gulf War happened, and I remember it very vividly because it was taking CNN live air and reporting in English, which was unusual because you know, it was Germany, and there was hours and hours of airtime in English. And at the end of every major segment, CNN would run credits saying this information was censored by, and then it would be just like 50 different organizations, and they included a whole number of American ones and British ones. And there was enormous public backlash over this. There were protests in the CNN headquarters in Atlanta, and employees had to be like escorted by police to their offices. And people were saying, you know, how dare you? You know, you're undermining our own country, and this and the fact is, people often do not want to be challenged. And honestly, people turn on TV a lot of times these days not for information, not to learn more, not to grow out of their ordinary way of seeing the world, but to have that reinforced or to be entertained. And if I can give just one more super quick example.
Yeah, but then I want to let Razak have the last word here, but go ahead.
Well, a much more trivial example, also back to CNN. But so I was in the newsroom when the John Bobbitt trial happened, like super sensational, super tabloid. The network was covering it live. Right at the same time, President Bill Clinton was heading to Ukraine to sign a major nuclear disarmament deal. And it just so happened that Lorena Bobbitt was taking the stand as Clinton was signing the deal. And there's a huge conference in the newsroom about what to do about this. They decide to split the screen, stay up on Lorena Bobbitt audio for as long as possible, and just break to Clinton for a few sentences. And in that space of time, the switchboard was flooded by complaints with angry viewers. And so this whole idea, it's a real dilemma for us going forward. Like, as educators, as journalists, are we going to give people what we think they need to know, a way to make them grow, or are we going to give them what they want to hear?
Well, tomorrow we're going to talk about where we are today. We're going to pick up on that and how we deal with this issue of truth moving forward. But Razak, we have literally 30 seconds left, but I just quickly want to hear from you. Given where you grew up in Iraq, when you look at the United States today and how the politically powerful try to use or manipulate the truth, are you optimistic or are you concerned about what's happening in the United States? We've only got about 15 seconds. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm a bit concerned. I just feel sad because I see the society in the U.S. It's divisive. It's divided. And I don't see it divided just among the politician, which is that's very normal. But unfortunately, I see the division among people themselves, among families themselves, you know, when they debate over, you know, politics. So that it concerns me.
Well, Razak Al-Saidi and Shelley Inglis and Cynthia Hooper, thank you all so much for joining me today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.